Wisdom literature is a genre of literature that was common in the ancient Near East. In the Bible, the books of Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes are considered wisdom literature. Psalms and Song of Solomon are sometimes included as well. They provide insights about how the world works and how to live wisely. In the next couple of episodes, I want to provide an introduction to wisdom, and specifically, biblical wisdom. In today's episode, I'm going to describe a true story that will set the stage for a more detailed examination of wisdom next week. To learn more, join me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. In a class I took on the topic of wisdom literature, one of the books I studied began with retelling a shocking event that helped to put wisdom in perspective. I found the story to be so impacting that I researched it further to know more details. So I want to share it with you because there are lessons that we can glean from the story. About 40 miles east of the city of Portland in the state of Oregon is the most climbed mountain in the Western Hemisphere, Mount Hood. It rises from near sea level to an impressive elevation of 11,200 feet. One of the reasons for its popularity is that from the base of the mountain, the climb looks deceptively easy. A small private school called Oregon Episcopal School had an annual rite of passage trip to Mount Hood. Modeled on the principles of Outward Bound, it was called Base Camp, and it was a required educational experience for all 10th graders. The idea was to help students grow by putting them in a challenging environment that required problem solving and teamwork. The school had been running this program for a number of years. In the months leading up to the spring trip in the year of 1986, instructors had taught students some technical aspects of snow climbing. The students learned about how to ascend and descend, how to self-arrest during a fall, how to perform basic first aid, and more. About an hour before midnight on Sunday, May 11th, which happened to be Mother's Day in 1986, a group of 15 teenagers assembled at the high school to gear up for the expedition to climb the majestic peak. This included 12 sophomores and 3 upper-class students who had a little higher level of training. In less than 12 hours, they expected to be standing on the summit of Mount Hood. They gathered up their harnesses, slings, a field stove, a sleeping bag, a large nylon tarp, 2 first aid kits, and more. The students boarded the bus along with the trip's leader, Thomas Goman, who was the school's 42-year-old chaplain and an Episcopal priest. Marion Horwell, the Dean of Residence and Student Affairs, came along to support her school, although she had never climbed a mountain before. One parent participated, Sharon Spray, who was accompanying her daughter, Hillary. After the 90-minute bus ride, the group arrived at Timberline Lodge. There they were joined by an Outward Bound instructor named Dee and by a 30-year-old professional guide named Ralph Summers. They were issued ice axes and helmets. The team also carried compasses, a set of long wands that would be used to mark their path on the way up and down, and a sturdy shovel designed for digging through ice-crusted snow. Typically, climbers leave between midnight and 4 a.m. and hike to the summit to see the sunrise and then head back down the mountain. On that night in May, Goman's group left Timberline Lodge around 2:30 a.m. for the roughly 6-mile round trip. There were 20 people in all, 15 male and female students, Goman, the group leader, one mother, one administrator, and the 2 guides. They were at 6,000 feet elevation, close to the tree line, and there was calf-deep snow on the ground. The temperatures were comfortably above freezing. Goman knew about an impending storm that forecasters had been warning about for the afternoon of May 12th. News organizations and weather services had predicted a multi-day storm with vicious winds and heavy marine moisture surging in. Goman assessed the conditions and decided that the climb could be completed safely anyway, before the worst of the weather hit. And given the calm weather at the time, leaving was not unreasonable. Goman had led many climbs before, so he had some experience. However, although he was very well liked and respected by the students and by his colleagues at the school, a former student of his later noted how there was a streak of recklessness in his character that he had witnessed firsthand on a different school outing. In that previous situation, when students expressed a hesitancy to leap from a cliff while tethered, Goman reportedly did the jump over and over, each time banging against the rocky cliff wall. He repeated the jump about 8 times until he was bloody, and it left the students traumatized. On Mount Hood on the morning of Monday, May 12th, initially the climb was pretty easy. The conditions and visibility were still fairly mild, but a few people began to have second thoughts about pushing on. The first to head down was a girl named Hillary and her mother, Sharon. At about 3:15 a.m., Hillary had a stomach ache and didn't feel fit enough to complete the climb, though she was urged to keep going. She says, "I was the first person to turn back. I did experience pressure from the leaders to continue. Tom Goman pressured the kids. We all assumed he knew what was best. I knew what was best for me was to turn around and leave." Around 5 o'clock a.m., they reached a warming station called Silcock's Hut at an elevation of about 7,000 feet. A student was in pain suffering from cramps, so she returned to the lodge with another climber. And two more climbers turned back soon after that. Around 8 a.m., they reached the Palmer Lift. And then at 11:30 a.m., another climber decided that she needed to go back because she was suffering from mild snow blindness, so she headed down the mountain alone. Now the group just had 13 people remaining. Within 2 hours after the last student's departure, bad weather descended suddenly. Goman thought the group could still reach the summit and get back down, so they pushed and pushed. As the weather worsened, Summers, the professional guide, began to question whether they should turn around. They didn't. Finally, around 2 or 3 p.m., they had trekked 6 or 7 hours past Palmer Lift. With the group above 10,000 feet and winds blowing hard, Summers went ahead of the group about 30 or 40 feet further and saw that the conditions were too precarious. He was finally able to convince Goman to turn around. But by then, it was too late. The storm had arrived. There was a relatively direct path down the mountain that they could take even in deteriorating weather, and the plan was to do that. But around 3:30 p.m., after the group was able to descend several hundred feet, a 15-year-old boy who was the youngest climber started struggling in the cold. He was a runner with a lean, athletic body, so he didn't have any insulating fat. His speech was slurred. He staggered and toppled over, just wanting to go to sleep. The students huddled around and placed him in the group's only sleeping bag. A fellow student climbed into the bag to help warm him. Summers used the field stove to boil water with 2 lemon drops, and the boy drank 12 ounces of hot liquid. This rewarming process helped, but it ate up almost an hour of time before the group could get going again. At this point, Summers took the lead. Goman had overcorrected the course to avoid a canyon, setting a compass to a heading that was 20 degrees off course. It's possible that Goman was having cognitive problems by this point, there was the strong possibility that fatigue and the cold were affecting him adversely at a much earlier state than others in the group were aware. As a result of the directional error, the climbers were moving almost directly sideways across the face of the mountain instead of down. As they proceeded, Summers noticed a crack in the snow and grew worried. He thought that they might be crossing an area called White River Glacier. Under any circumstances, crossing a glacier is dangerous because its crevasses are not always visible. In a blizzard, blowing snow undergoes a process called mechanical hardening, meaning it can accumulate in caps or bridges over empty space. These bridges can collapse when you step on them. Summers said to the group, "Follow my footsteps and do not step on the crack." By this point, visibility was less than 10 feet and winds were getting stronger. After leading the group past the crack, Summers moved ahead. Before long, he felt his foot go over an edge abruptly. Then he saw another crevasse, which looked to be 30 feet deep. By this time, it was around 7 p.m. Now remember, they should have been back by noon or early afternoon, and it's now 7 p.m. Considering the late hour and the fact that one student could not walk unassisted, and they did not know their exact location, and they found themselves on a glacier with at least one large crevasse, Summers decided that the best option was to dig in. So he started digging a snow cave. It turns out that they weren't on the glacier, but were near its edge at an altitude of 8,200 feet. Summers and Goman worked together to dig a cave in about an hour, measuring 6 feet by 8 feet and 4 feet high inside. It was only big enough to fit six, and they had 13 people. So they set up a rotation, taking turns sitting outside in the gale force winds. Inside the cave wasn't much better. It was claustrophobic, and the walls soon began to thaw from body heat. Snowmelt accumulated in a slushy trough on the cave floor. Anybody in the middle ended up in a shallow pool of ice water. Terrified, the students struggled to breathe. They were panicking about the air. They also struggled to keep the cave mouth open. At some point during the night, the wind outside the cave entrance sucked away both the shovel and the sleeping bag. Without the shovel, the students had to try to keep the entrance clear with an ice axe and by moving in and out of the cave. By first light on Tuesday morning, the situation had become untenable. Summers asked Goman to count to 10. And he was unable to. Summers decided that he had to leave to try to get down and find rescuers. One of the older students volunteered to go with him, and they vanished into the whiteout. Summers and the student veered badly off course, but a few hours later, by 9:50 a.m., they ended up making it to another ski resort lodge that was roughly 2 miles east of the Timberline Lodge. Unbeknownst to the climbers, in the early hours of Tuesday, May 13th, members of the Portland Mountain Rescue, the PMR, had received news that there were student climbers on Mount Hood who hadn't returned. The PMR showed up at the base of Mount Hood in the middle of the storm. They reached the Timberline Lodge at 5:21 a.m. on Tuesday. One of the volunteers later said that in his whole climbing career, which included summiting Mount Hood at least 460 times, he had never seen the weather so bad. The winds were 103 miles per hour, which qualifies as a Category 2 hurricane. You can't stand up, and with the blowing snow, there is zero visibility. The rescuers would be risking their lives. At 8:53 a.m., the ground crew from a unit of Air Force pararescuers arrived. The sheriff's office established a staging area and sent searchers out into the weather. But they found nothing. They had no idea, after all, where to look, since the whiteout meant that helicopters couldn't fly. And even though Summers and the student had returned, they didn't know exactly where they were on the mountain. And Summers was not able to give good information to the searchers. Searching through the worst of the storm, covering a vast snowblown area, the volunteers struggled to see or hear anything. The wind howled, snow piled up, visibility for parts of the day was less than an arm's length. The severity of this storm was certainly one of the worst this mountain had ever encountered. During the initial day of searching, the winds were strong enough that they flipped over a snowcat. After it was put back upright, a window popped out, and still the volunteers went out, but they couldn't find the climbers. All day Tuesday, back at the snow cave, the remaining 11 people waited, vacillating between hope and despair. The air was cold and damp. It must have been painful to breathe. And the cave opening was getting smaller as new snow kept coming in. Sometime on Tuesday night, with the blizzard still raging, the cave's entrance was nearly sealed shut. One student who had crawled outside tried to get back in, but he couldn't get more than a single boot back through the entrance. 4 feet of snow had accumulated in 24 hours. And at this point, the mouth of the cave was effectively sealed. 3 students were outside. 8 people were squished inside, buried now deep under the snow. The weather finally cleared on early Wednesday morning. Around 2 a.m., rescuers rode in a snowcat from Mount Hood Meadows up the side of the mountain. They had to shelter in place for several hours, but around 5:45 a.m. after sunrise, they noticed 2 black dots in an area called White River Canyon. They went to investigate. It was the lifeless bodies of 2 girls curled in a fetal position, trying to stay warm. Around this time, not far away, a different set of rescuers found the body of the boy who had tried to get back inside the cave, but couldn't fit. So the 3 students stuck outside of the cave were all found deceased. But the rescuers didn't know where the rest were. The weather had finally cleared, but all signs of the climbers had been erased due to the heavy winds and snow. The climbers didn't have an altimeter with them, so it was anyone's guess as to what elevation the snow cave had been constructed. Different groups were hunting for the cave, and Summers was trying to guide the helicopter to the position that he thought the cave was at, but he couldn't remember exactly. Finally, later that afternoon, on Wednesday, in a last-ditch effort, they organized a group of searchers into a fine probe line, starting at 8,500 feet and working about 3 feet apart. The rescuers moved slowly down the slope, pushing 10-foot avalanche poles into the snow. It was a last desperate measure, and it worked. At 5:38 p.m., just 22 minutes before the scheduled end of that day's search, one of the volunteers hit something solid. Frantically, everyone started digging. When they located the cave, it had a bad smell. And then they heard moaning. From inside the tiny space, a student was semi-conscious and moaning. And then a second student was found barely alive as well. There were no other survivors in the cave. The 2 students were rushed to the hospital. One went into cardiac arrest, but the surgeons opened his chest and massaged his heart until it resumed its usual rhythm. The doctors fought valiantly to keep him alive, but they couldn't save his legs. 20 people had embarked on the expedition, and 9 of them died. 7 of the victims were teenagers, students at a well-intentioned school who followed the lead of adults they trusted. Their designated leader, probably suffering from the onset of hypothermia, kept moving the team higher and higher when they should have turned around. The apparent simplicity of the hike, coupled with the mountain's majestic beauty, has made Mount Hood both alluring and dangerous. In the past century, more than 120 people have died on it. There are clear risks: avalanches, falls, crevasses, and the weather can turn bad in minutes. Specifically, this Mount Hood disaster had a number of root causes: fatigue, exposure, hypothermia, inadequate equipment, terrible weather that should have been anticipated, poor judgment in the decision to not turn back until it was too late, and then a failure to follow the correct route back. The Mount Hood disaster with the Oregon Episcopal School remains to this day the second deadliest alpine accident in North American history. Outdoor programs are popular, and they're based on the idea that the potential for gain, such as personal growth, decision-making, critical thinking, and problem-solving, leadership, etc., outweighs the risks. But the risks exist. The group of students from Oregon Episcopal School had enough training for the expected climbing conditions, but they were unprepared in terms of gear, knowledge, and experience for the actual conditions they faced. And the risks are not just for the inexperienced. Even the most experienced climbers have lost their lives to Mount Hood's unpredictable weather patterns, hidden crevasses, and unexpected drop-offs. In December of 2009, three well-trained and well-equipped climbers attempted to scale the summit. When they failed to return as scheduled, a full-scale rescue effort was launched. The next day, the body of one of the climbers was found on a steep section of a glacier. The search continued for several more days, but was called off for bad weather. It was 8 months later before the bodies of the other two climbers were found. Signal transmitters were available to hikers at Timberline Lodge, a new technology that had been added after the 1986 tragedy. But the three climbers in 2009 didn't want to carry the tracking devices. For many climbers, they feel like it intrudes on their freedom and self-reliance. But experienced climbers are vulnerable because they can have a tendency to be overly confident in their skills, equipment, and their physical abilities. So both inexperienced and experienced climbers are vulnerable. Why? While the downfall of the inexperienced climbers is their naivete, the downfall of experienced climbers is their pride. So what does this have to do with the topic of wisdom? Scholars Dave Bland and David Fleer describe it this way: the way climbers approach Mount Hood serves as an analogy for the way that we face life. Life is an exciting journey, an adventure with unknown challenges stretching before us. For those venturing into adulthood, it can appear deceptively easy to manage. But life often throws unexpected twists and turns along the way. While it presents wonderful opportunities and joys, hidden perils abound. It involves risks and difficult decisions. Our world does not prepare individuals well for this journey, regardless of the level of experience. Both the novice and the experienced must remain constantly vigilant. And it is at this point that wisdom speaks a profound word into our experience. Wisdom capably negotiates the complexities of life. Wisdom seeks to discover God's order in life and then proceeds to fit into that order, always acknowledging human limitations. In the next episode, we're going to talk more about what wisdom is and what the Bible teaches us about wisdom. Thank you for joining me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. And until next time, take care and God bless.